You're listening to North Atlantic Radio with your hosts Brian Suda and Matt Riggett.
As you may have noticed, we've replaced our introductory speaker with the Google Translate. We previously were doing the text-to-speech with the Apple voices. We thought, since in this podcast we're talking a bunch about Google, we'd give the Google Translate a go. In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the interesting things that Google's come out with recently. We're going to talk a little bit about HTML5 and the gaming world, and then a little bit of heroes and villains, and which books we're reading. But how do you think it went this week, Matt?
It's okay. Yeah, well, it went well. Good topics. Interesting chat, as always. We're still having trouble with Skype, though. For those of you that don't know, Brian's in Reykjavik. I'm in Glasgow, so we record this by having a Skype phone call. But the connections, I'm sure the connection's getting worse and worse the longer we do this. So we have a bit of trouble chatting to each other. Sometimes we don't hear each other, so we're like two deaf old men having a chat. But yeah, the topics were good, and I enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, this is what, episode number 10?
Yes, 10.
So we've been doing this since May 2009, coming up on 2010.
And this is the Christmas special, so it should be a little bit longer. We certainly hope it will be. Once the edit's done, it should be longer than the usual 15 minutes. So enjoy.
Yeah, later in the podcast, this will make sense, but my site is 74% faster.
74%?
74.
Ooh.
So
okay.
This will make sense.
Not as fast as my site then, Brian.
No, don't spoil the ending.
First off, some of Google's recent releases. In the last couple of weeks, they've released a few interesting things. First is Speedy, second is the Google DNS, and the third is the Labs feature they've added to Webmaster Central. So Speedy first. How much do you know about Speedy, Brian?
Well, just the little bit that you sent me. Basically, it's a new way to do HTTP, where instead of requesting a page and then requesting the CSS and the JavaScript and images that are in the page, it sounds like it just bundles everything up and sends it over in one package, and then on client side it unpacks it all. So it should save on the number of requests and some of the overhead.
Yeah, it's kind of optimizing a lot of the stuff that are pretty crappy to do with HTTP, but we kind of just take for granted, because it compresses headers as well, doesn't it, to cut down on the overhead of each request as well. Like you say, it's kind of got something like HTML5 manifest, and there's some really technical things in the background as well that I think front-end developers won't have to worry about, but people writing browsers and servers will they'll want to incorporate into their, or they'll need to incorporate into their software if they want to support Speedy.
Right. I think a lot of the things, when you get into really big sites, the Firebug tool tells you a lot of the kind of pros and cons, like you're making too many requests, or you've got too many DNS lookups, or your files aren't gzipped. A lot of that sort of stuff is just going to be got for free with Speedy. Now, saying that, you did mention the HTML5 manifests, and this is something that more, I guess, client-side developers would be, should be using or can be using to accomplish quite a lot of the same information. The HTML manifest is a zip file of all of the corresponding images and CSS and JavaScript, pretty much any of the static content. And it was originally designed for offline apps, but I don't see why it couldn't just be used in general. So when you request a page, www.example.com, it pulls that page down, and then the first thing it also finds is a manifest. And then instead of pulling all the images and everything down, it goes and gets that zipped up manifest, unpacks it, and then runs. Basically, it's kind of like telling it everything that should be cached, both online and offline, all in this one file.
The manifest, I mean, it's a very fancy name. It's actually just a link to it's an attribute on the HTML element of an HTML5 document that links to a file, which just, I don't think it's necessarily a zip file. I thought it was the manifest just contains a list of files that a browser should make available offline. So if you just list, 10 or 20 files, like the images, background images, the CSS, the JavaScript, an HTML5, a browser that supports HTML5 can get all of those images and cache them, and it won't request them again until your manifest changes. So yeah, the idea behind it is so that you can have offline applications, and once you get them in your browser the first time, you don't have to make a web request for any again. We'll come on to something that's used this in an upcoming segment, but yeah, some of the speedy stuff sounds very familiar, doesn't it? That it enables you to list all the files that it will need to run an app or a website in the protocol, and then a browser that supports speedy will get all the files you need, and then that's it. You've reduced the requests down and therefore increase the speed of your site as well. So there's some good things in it, but I know one of the things you said you weren't sure about was the uptake of speedy. How likely it is that browsers are going to support
it? Yeah, one of the requirements is that everything has to be passed over SSL, so it means it's encrypted and zipped. That's part of the package format. So there is overhead on the server side, especially if you have dynamic content, if it's like something like Flickr, where it's your photos and you're logged in, you're not logged in, they can't necessarily save all of those states as just zip files laying around. So the server has to, find the files, compress it in real time, and then send it over SSL, which is encrypted. And then at the other end, you have to have a browser that actually supports this. So I don't think it's going to, it's not going to be rolled out anytime soon. I mean, we're still dealing with IE6 browsers, and mobile phones and, mobile clients are going to be even older, and the upgradability of, some of the firmware on those just isn't going to happen. So as nice as speedy is, I don't foresee it taking off.
Yeah, I mean, it could be something similar to what we saw a decade or so ago, where you had HTTP 1 and HTTP 1.1, and servers, well, they still do, but servers will support both protocols and use the protocol that the browser supports. So an older, crappier browser would use HTTP 1, and a newer browser would support HTTP 1.1 and would get all the benefits from that. So it could be something with speedy. I mean, I'm sure, seeing as this is a Google project, Google Chrome will support it at some point if they're serious about it. So maybe that people using Google Chrome will be using speedy when they use Google sites, Google Mail and the search engine itself, and Google Wave or whatever else we're using in a year or two. This brings us on sort of to one of the other Google things I mentioned, Google DNS, in that they've released their own DNS. And I'm still trying to work out why they've done that. I mean, obviously it's very nice of them. If it's faster than the average DNS, that's great because you get a better service. But what's in it for Google? Some people suggested that maybe they're just the speed, because they're just always looking for ways to increase the speed of pages, and DNS is just that ever so slight overhead that Google can do better than your ISP, and so they can increase the speed that way. But it just seems, I mean, there's such a small market. The number of people that know what DNS is and know how to change their DNS and have the impetus to change their DNS, I mean, that's a tiny percentage of the people that will be using the web. So why bother?
Two things that come to mind immediately would be, in my lifetime doing websites and service admin stuff, I haven't moved that many websites around. But Google knows about 8 billion web pages. They might know, when someone changes their DNS, there's a 24, 48, 72 hour lag time. So maybe it's if people are hosting their DNS with Google and something changes, they change hosting providers or something, Google Spider, Googlebot, will find it a lot faster because they know exactly what IP to be searching at. They don't have to wait for DNS to propagate all the way through. But also, Google allows you a lot with their Google Apps. So you can set up, mail.yourdomain.com or docs.yourdomain. And that means you have to edit the A record and MX record for mail and stuff like that. But if they're hosting the DNS, it might make it a lot easier, and they might have some more GUI, WYSIWYG kind of things just in their applications. I don't know.
Yeah,
it does seem
I think along with that as well, this may be part of a larger plan that they haven't, we're not aware of yet. When they first released Gmail, it was like, oh, wow, Google Email, that's lovely, that's great. I wonder why they're doing this, though. And then, of course, years later, you see there was part of a larger plan to have like a hosted service of apps and docs and, email and docs and calendar and other things that they sell as a product. So the Google DNS could be something to do with Android, Chrome OS, or just something to do with the stack. Yeah,
Google
something
sites.
To do with the stack that they just want to make Chrome OS, Android, and Google Chrome generally just super fast, and these are two of the ways that they're improving that. But we shall see. And we mentioned one other Google piece of Google software they've released recently is in Webmaster Central. There's a Labs feature. I don't know if it's got a name. It's something like Site Speed Checker or something. And it tells you how fast your website is, as long as you're using Google Webmaster tools. But it tells you how fast your website is in comparison to the rest of the internet. Do you know the figure for your site, Brian?
No, I haven't even looked. I should have. Do you know yours?
My site's faster than 88% of the internet or the web. I'm quite pleased with that. But it, as well as telling you how fast or slow your site is in relation to everything that Google indexes, it gives you a few pointers on how you can speed up your site. So it's similar to the functionality you can get with YSlow and other tools, in that it says, you know, gzip this and it'll speed it up, or reduce the number of DNS requests you make here and stuff. So it gives you practical advice as well. But it's nice to see an overall figure relative to the rest of the web as well.
Yeah, because the YSlow was and is still an internal tool for Yahoo and Yahoo properties. So a lot of their recommendations, like, ooh, I see your site isn't on a CDN. You're like, well, I don't need a content distribution network. I've got 30 people visiting my site a week. The Google Speed Checker is a little more broad in what their recommendations are.
Yeah, absolutely. as always, links to all these tools and the news articles about them in the show notes.
Our next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about HTML5 games. And this is an interesting one because it's kind of combining several different topics we've talked about in the past, specifically more, you know, games online, both Flash and non-Flash, and combining in with a lot of the new HTML, HTML5 technologies. And there's a game, I can't remember the name of it now. Yes, well, there's Pie Guy, and then there's another one. I just deleted it off my phone. But we'll have a link to it. And basically the whole thing is pretty impressive. It's a little side-scrolling game, kind of like the early Lode Runner, where you're jumping around, climbing up ladders, and avoiding bad guys. And the entire thing is written in HTML5. And the great part about it is, because it's using the manifest and because it's using a lot of the cutting-edge technology that WebKit can handle, I can play the thing offline. So when I was on a flight a couple weeks ago, I was sitting there happily playing, you know, this video game completely out of HTML5. So it's really got me thinking about getting into things and kind of writing my own, just quick and simple video game purely in HTML5. People can play it in the browser, they can play it in compliant phones, and then on devices like the iPhone or iPod Touch, they can happily play it offline. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, where this is going.
Yeah, the guy, the Pie Guy, I know the game you're talking about, I can't think of the game either, but the other game, Pie Guy, it's a rip-off of Pac-Man, or not a rip-off, but, you know, a reimagining or something. But it's really nicely done. If you go there for the first time, it's iPhone specific, but HTML5 games aren't necessarily just for the iPhone, but he's written it deliberately for the iPhone. And if you go to the webpage for the game in your iPhone for the first time, it comes up, rather than having the game, it comes up and says, you need to add this to your home screen. So you click the bookmark link, add it to your screen, and then when you get it on your screen, like you would have with any other apps on your phone, it just works exactly like any other game you have on your iPhone. You load it up. The first time you load it, it'll pick up the HTML5 manifest. It'll download everything it needs to run that first time, and that's it. Like Brian says, after that first time, it's offline. You can play it on the plane. You can play it underground. You know, you can play it without Wi-Fi, and it's really, really good. The only thing that's missing from it now, that would the only thing where you could guess that it wasn't a native game, is that it can't, or it doesn't handle music, so it's a silent game. And we were trying to think earlier of ways you could include audio in a HTML5 game, and you had quite a snazzy way of doing it, I think, didn't you, Brian?
Yeah, I had read somewhere there was a stat about the number of applications that utilize sound, and really with the, you know, with the touch technology, you're doing pretty well getting a lot of the other kind of senses. You got your visual sense, your tactile touch, but audio is, you know, one of the simple things that a lot of people kind of forget about. So when I was, you know, coming up with ideas for this game, HTML5 game, we could almost go back to the old school days of little MIDI files, and, you know, or even WAV files, because with HTML5 you'll have the audio element, and you can, you know, play those, and they're scriptable, so you can load them up with jQuery or change it, or as things happen you can, you know, play multiple, you know, files at the same time. But, you know, I've really been into this whole generative art and generative music, and there's a great app for the iPhone, Bloom, written by Brian Eno and some other folks, where it's always changing and morphing. So I thought, is there a way to actually do this? With music as well. And I mean, so I got to thinking, and I found some sources online for how to actually create MIDI files at the hex level. So you can actually inject hex codes, and it, you know, it's different notes and different tones. That's an absolute nightmare to figure out. But the other thing that makes it even worse is with HTML5 manifest, you can't have any dynamic files because everything's running in the browser. You couldn't have, you know, some PHP script or Ruby or anything like that because it's running client side. So I've been looking into ways to have JavaScript generate the hex codes or hex values and then run it through Base64. So basically you get a Base64 encoding of a MIDI file, and then using JavaScript inject that into an audio element with a data URI. So you could be able to dynamically generate random music or styles of music on the fly in JavaScript and play them client side. I have no idea if it's going to actually work or what sort of processing power it's going to take, but it should be a nice little experiment.
The great thing about these HTML5 games is, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. One thing I wanted to say first was we were wondering as well if you could create, but as part of your HTML5 manifest, if you could download, if you could provide MP3s, and then using JavaScript, if you dynamically created HTML5 audio elements with any one of the MP3s that are part of your manifest, so you could actually play music as the game went on just by creating the audio element, pointing to MP3 and auto playing it, and, you know, maybe switching the music as necessary, or I guess you could play music, you know, multiple files at once. I'd imagine browsers are powerful enough, but we haven't actually tested that. It's probably something we should test.
Well, the other thing with MP3 is I think you can start at any point in the file. You just give it, you know, like pound 314, okay, and it'll jump to minute 314.
It should be quite possible to have a HTML5 game with audio as well. But yeah, the great thing about HTML5 games is, I mean, how long have we been doing this podcast? 8 months, something like that? And since May. So we started and we were like, oh, the potential's there. I'd love to see it happen. And then there was a couple, I think in the last episode, we linked to a guy that had duplicated a level of another world in JavaScript and HTML5. So it's like, and there's a prototype, and then this episode we can link to a full-on HTML5 game that's been created. And we've talked before about native 3D graphics in the browser. So this isn't even just a theory anymore, a hypothetical situation. This is happening. HTML5 and JavaScript is still at the very early stages, but it's actually a plausible way to create games. And it's great to see. folks, this episode's Heroes and Villains, but as it's the Christmas special, we're getting into the festive spirit, and we're not going to have any villains this month because everything should be happy and presents and smiles. So just heroes this month. I'll start off with my hero, which is the UK's Guardian newspaper. Just the other day, they released an iPhone application. I'm a big fan of The Guardian, so I've been waiting for ages and ages for an iPhone app from The Guardian, because as much as their website's fantastic in the browser, it's just massive. I think the front page, depending on what they've gotten, is between half a meg and a meg to download, so it's just too bulky. It takes too long to read on my iPhone, and I've been hoping for an iPhone app for ages, and they finally released one, and it's a really, really good job. They've really thought it through, I think. The homepage is, you can customize what articles you have on it and what sections of the paper you see. It's got an offline mode as well, so if you tend to be in and out of Wi-Fi zones or whatever, you can just load it up. It'll download all the news that you want from, you know, the sections of your choice. Next time you load it up, they'll all be there and you can read them in full. And it's a really good implementation. It's £2.39, I think. So it's not particularly expensive, but it's nice to see newspapers. We're going to go on to journalism after this, but it's nice to see newspapers looking for alternative ways for payment rather than just groaning that Google News is stealing their content and trying to shut everyone off with paywalls. It's nice to see a newspaper that's going out there and trying to embrace the web rather than kicking it away. Anyway, my hero this episode is the Guardian newspaper for their iPhone app.
My hero this podcast is WikiLeaks. They've managed to do some pretty interesting leaks in the last several months, from leaking some of the banking documents in Iceland to the 9/11 pager information, and most recently this whole Tiger Woods gag order. Now, frankly, I don't care in the least bit what Tiger Woods did or didn't do or anything, but it seems sometimes pretty silly how easy it is to get around. If someone wants to say something bad about you, true or not, you can get a gag order without actually any sort of very light legal looking intos. So WikiLeaks has been there to kind of make sure we don't get quite silly or overzealous with a lot of this legalese. So I quite enjoy some of the stuff they get through, especially recently. I think the one I looked at before I came here, some companies were threatening the BBC, so the BBC removed a few articles, and WikiLeaks had a cache, so they're not going to let big corporations snuff out the news. So they're my hero this week.
Next up, another favorite of Brian and mine is journalism and the web. There's been a lot of talk recently, especially from Rupert Murdoch, on the idea of paywalls, that is, restricting your content to only those who have paid for it. So in the case of Murdoch's newspapers, his idea is that you can only read an article if you've either paid, like £1 to read that specific article, or perhaps if you've got a monthly subscription to his website of £5, £10, you can read anything you want. The reason being is Murdoch is particularly unhappy with the amount of money he's making from the internet, or rather the amount of money he's not making, and so he's desperately trying to paint Google and everyone else as the bad guy, while making himself look good and giving himself an excuse to charge for his content. He faces a lot of problems. One being that there's a study by, let's see if I can find the link, a group, a media consultancy called Oliver and Albaum. They did a study recently to show that whereas people tend to be quite loyal to where they read their news in print, so they're very loyal to the particular paper they read, online there's no such loyalty. They'll just... they'll have probably like 10 or 15 or more trusted sources, and they'll just take the news from there. So if Rupert Murdoch brings in a paywall for his papers in the UK, whereas people seem to be obviously happy to pay for printed news, they would just go to their other sources. So they wouldn't, rather than suddenly deciding to pay because they're desperate to read what The Sun says, they'll go to the mirror or heat or, you know, the other peers of the sun. So he's got that problem in that how is he going to keep people going to his site when he puts a paywall up? There's also the fact that he'll lose a ton of links, because if people can't read his news, they won't link to it. If Google can't index it, no one will be able to find it. So he's got that problem. And in the UK and other countries that have serious public service broadcasting, he's got the BBC factor. So even if every newspaper in the country decided to start charging, you've still got the BBC, which are obliged almost to offer a free service. They're certainly never going to charge for it. So the ideas Rupert Murdoch seems to be coming up with these is, first of all, to attack the BBC as much as he can, in the hope that eventually people will start listening to him and either stop the BBC from producing a BBC, a news website, therefore getting rid of that problem, or even, you know, cutting the BBC's budget, reducing its remit, blah blah blah, to solve that problem. The other one is that supposedly there's this idea that perhaps he can try and get every newspaper to create a paywall, therefore that if you've got no kind of traditional news sources on the web to go to without paying, you'll choose your favorite and pay. But I mean, it just seems generally really flawed,
right? Like I was telling you earlier, it breaks down to the, you know, prisoner's dilemma, in the sense that if he, you know, if he gets everybody to quit, the guy at the very bottom is going to say, hang on, if I don't quit, I'll be the number one news source. And the number two guy on the bottom says, well, hang on, if I don't quit, then I'll be the number one news source. And it just trickles up the chain. So pretty quickly, when everybody goes behind a paywall, whoever's left is going to be the top result in Google. So everyone wants to be the top result in Google, so therefore they're not going to join the paywall.
Absolutely, yeah. It just takes one person to disagree and the whole idea is screwed. And it just doesn't seem feasible. I mean, even if you got all the newspapers to charge for their website, you've still got everything else. You've got blogs, you've got things like the Huffington Post that are online only, and, you know, the equivalent to the other side of the political spectrum. I mean, there's no chance you're going to get to the point when enough of the market has got a paywall that people will just accept that they have to pay. For good or ill, the internet, people have decided with the internet, or with the web certainly, that things should just be free, and that's going to be a tough one to sell to people, especially when it's so much easier now
to
get.
Not only, I mean, just
news.
Look at the fact that The Guardian is a newspaper in the UK. You can get a subscription. They've got a free website, and you just paid money for their iPhone app. So, you know, they have a one-off paywall subscription of £2.39. And they're making money alternative ways without putting up a paywall.
Yeah, exactly. I think really they're people who are interested in paywalls are just looking at the wrong thing completely. They're stuck in the old mindset, and they're trying to force it onto the web, and really they should be doing other things and looking for other ways to make money. I think it's certainly a tough period. There's no pretending that there's a silver bullet where you can just, you know, suddenly start making money from the internet, but trying to do the same as you've always done in a different medium isn't going to work. You need to do things like charge people for an iPhone app. People won't pay to access your website, but there's a different mindset on for mobile applications. People are willing to pay. The Guardian have gone for a one-off payment when you download the app, but equally you could ask people, you know, you could charge people a quid a month or something like that, and see if you can make money that way. But it's certainly hard to try and work out a way that newspapers can make money. Advertising doesn't get them anywhere near as much as they used to. People won't pay to access their websites, so the obvious ideas are gone. But putting up a paywall is the wrong answer, and I'm sure it's destined to fail. Which leads us on nicely to something I read about a week or so ago, the idea of reporting as opposed to journalism. Something Brian and I have been talking about via email for the last week or so. Reporting is the thing that Twitter and other social media, Facebook as well, is really good at. The famous recent example is the Hudson plane crash, where a guy who just survived the plane crashing into the Hudson River in New York got on his phone and sent a message to Twitter almost immediately saying, oh my God, I've just been in a plane crash or something. And the news spread like wildfire. That's reporting, and that's something that newspapers are never going to be the best at anymore, because they're just not geared up to be that quick in reporting the facts. And speed is seems to be the thing that people are most concerned with here. There are obvious problems. Twitter particularly has problems in that with verification of facts. So, I mean, anyone can just put, oh my God, I've just been in a plane crash, and it goes, you know, it spreads like wildfire. But you've got the, you've got to try and prove that that's true, and that's something that you know, social media will be struggling with for a while, I think. But anyway, the thing that newspapers can do to separate themselves is to focus on journalism. So the reporting is the, this plane has just crashed, and journalism is the, why did it crash? And that's the thing I think that newspapers can be much better at than social media, is not just the reporting of the facts, but the comment on it, and the asking the questions and doing the long research and the investigative journalism into those things to find out exactly why something happened. And I think that's how newspapers can you know, use the web and start to make money from the web.
Well, yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, there's a huge difference between journalism and reporting. And you're right that, you know, social media, even just the, you know, connectivity we have now between devices and SMS and, you know, pagers and cell phones, they allow us to report things a lot faster. You know, Michael Jackson is going to the hospital, or all these sort of, you know, stories about Tiger Woods again, or like you said, the Hudson River example. But it doesn't, yeah, you said it doesn't, it's not journalism. And while you think that that's where newspapers should focus, and I think that's where they can be competitive, because they can't be competitive on, you know, reporting, but they can be competitive in their style of writing or their slant or how they bring it together. But I also think that, not right now, but I think in the future, we can compile enough reporting from social media and create journalism from that. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I think there's an opportunity for, you know, another Turing type test. You know, the famous Turing test is you have a conversation through a computer terminal, and you have to try and figure out if it's a computer or a person. I think there's an opportunity for, you get an article of text. Was it written by a human being, or was it compiled with AI and algorithms from, you know, a corpus of online social media? And I think, you know, not today, but I think soon, it would be a difficult one to figure out.
Yeah. I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast before. We had an idea that we would try and like duplicate a newspaper on the web, but using only information from Twitter. So we try and build headlines and grab pictures just from things that people are saying and that have been retweeted on Twitter, to see if we could do as good a job at reporting the news as newspapers were. And this is the idea you've just talked about, is a step up from that. Is it's not just the reporting of the news, but could a computer be as good as a human set of editors at investigating the news as well, and doing that kind of lower level journalism? And yeah, the Turing test comes into it. When once someone can no longer tell the difference between the two, we've well, what are we doing? We're ruling the world, winning.
Well, yeah, we yeah. Yeah, that's it. The robots have taken over. I think, though, it's interesting because, like I said, we've been doing this since May, and we had this idea quite early on. And I would say now that that today it's not even feasible, because I think in the last 6 months, somewhere along the line, Twitter went mainstream. And if you look at any of the top trending topics, there's no way you could build a newspaper around those. They're completely pointless. It's all spam and noise. So I think it'd be difficult to regenerate a newspaper, you know, front page just from Twitter, because the trending stuff now is not the same quality as something like the BBC or CNN homepage.
Yeah, right. Actually, one other thing as well, we mentioned when we were talking about this earlier in the week, was we probably sound like we're kind of advocating the idea that Twitter should be only source for news, but we're actually saying that that would be a problem in itself as well, because if you limited yourself to one source, you'd miss out on so much more. For example, Twitter's massive in the Western world, but I think in Brazil, actually, Facebook's massive in the Western world, isn't it? But Brazil, is it, what's the name of the social networking system they use there? Is it Orkut or something?
Yeah,
Orkut's
I think so.
Much Google more massive one. Than Facebook, and
I think
it's similar. In
Bebo is bigger than in Ireland.
Sorry?
I mean, there's Bebo, I think, is bigger in Ireland than Facebook. Right. There's just random little pockets that have taken off and people have just stuck with
it. Yeah, and there was something, I can't think of the name of it, it begins with P, but there's a service that's much more popular in Asia than China, in Asia than Twitter. And, you know, if you focus just on one source, then you'd miss out on a huge read of news, which is, again, where... if you know where reporting needs to come from, just more than one source. But to go back to your point, though, I think certainly there's a good possibility that reporting can be done pragmatically. I guess Google News does that now, but using just social networking, the journalism, I don't think it's anywhere near that stage yet, because computers aren't capable of asking questions like why and how. Whereas human journalists are, you know, it's a skilled job, but reporting, I think, is certainly an algorithmic problem that's really coming to the fore at the moment.
Yeah, maybe there's an opportunity for building tools to aggregate reporting to help journalists write better articles. I mean, give the journalists the time to write rather than the time to research, because they can, you know, we can do the researching and the data gathering, like I said, programmatically. And just, you know, give them the ability to do what they do best. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the site of the podcast, something that I learned about just a couple weeks ago. I was at a conference called CodeBits in Lisbon, and there was a presentation about a open source project called PhoneGap. I think the website is just phonegap.com. We'll have a link to it on the website. And this is an incredible, you know, first of all, the idea is great, and I know there's a couple closed source systems, so the fact that this is even open source makes it even that much cooler. And PhoneGap allows you to write applications for mobile devices in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and they give you a couple extra additional libraries that you can just write in your JavaScript, things like has accelerometer or is, you know, shifted or has beep or, you know, get screen sizes. And you just write your code, try and catch, if, else, whatever, and write it all in HTML, CSS, and then you just say compile, and it compiles down to an iPhone app or a Symbian or Nokia or Palm Pre. And if the device, the target device, is an iPhone that has a magnometer, which is a fancy word for compass, or accelerometers, then it uses that little bit of code. If you're on an old Symbian device, which doesn't have a touch screen and doesn't have accelerometers, it falls back to your if else and, you know, does something else. So again, segueing right nice from, you know, any HTML5 games you might make. Now you can slap them in an application, compile them down, and sell them on various, you know, iTunes store or different mobile marketplaces and make a little bit of money. It's the easiest way to build a proper compiled application is reuse the skills you know.
Yeah, it looked good when you sent it to me. We weren't quite sure what it compiled down to. You thought it was, you wrote in HTML and JavaScript, but it actually compiled down to native code, doesn't it? So you'd compile it for the iPhone and you'd get, you know, Objective-C code. You'd compile it for the Android and you'd get Java-based code.
I think it does that, and there's a bit of a wrapper for, I don't know if it's just embedding a browser in an application and then having the hooks, or if it's got to be some, you know, something like that, because it's certainly not rewriting your HTML into, you know, Objective-C. It's just putting that middle layer in between.
And finally, as always, the books that Brian and I have been reading since the last episode. Now I'm going to just have a slightly longer segment than usual, you'll be happy to know. I'm going to mention the book I was reading last time, The Forgotten Prime Minister, the 14th Earl of Derby. I think in the last podcast I kind of dismissed it out of hand and said it was boring. And after we'd released the podcast, I felt a bit guilty about that because it's a massive book. It's two volumes, in fact. This obviously some guys like life work, and I just dismissed it out of hand, so I felt pretty bad for that. So I'm still reading it, and it's okay. It's not actually boring. I was just a bit bored with it at the time, but I just thought I'd give it a bit of a critique, a proper critique, rather than just dismissing it. Anyway, so The Forgotten Prime Minister, the 14th Earl of Derby, we'll link to it, is about a British Prime Minister in the, I think he was three times Prime Minister in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s. And I think traditionally he's been thought of as a bit of a chump. He was, not particularly good at the job, a bit lackadaisical, typical aristocratic Prime Minister in that he didn't really take the job that seriously. It was just kind of, a birthright, and it was fun to do, but he didn't put too much effort into it. And the idea of this biography was that it was supposed to kind of throw that idea out the window and show he was a really strong Prime Minister and, had the Parliament under his control. And I actually think it doesn't show that at all. I think it shows exactly what everyone thinks of the Earl of Derby. His, for instance, between 1852 and 1855, Derby comes across as a really ineffectual leader, even in this book. I think the author tries his best, but it's more about what he doesn't say than what he does. It's really quite obvious that for those 3 years Derby was in opposition, he really didn't do much. I mean, part of the problem was he had serious gout, so he was housebound for a lot of the time. But even when the Conservative Party was, having massive arguments in civil war and was on the verge of splitting, he just kind of let it happen and took a really laissez-faire style of approach to leadership. And even eventually in 1855, when Palmerston resigns, Derby, it's nothing Derby does that means Palmerston resigns. It's due to the way the government is handling things. And even when Palmerston resigns and Derby is primed to go in and become Prime Minister again, he plays this really high-risk strategy and actually loses and ends up not Prime Minister for another few years. So I actually think that the book, while I'm trying to paint Derby as this, fantastic leader, it doesn't. It kind of reinforces the ideas that have been around for ages, that Derby was actually not that great. So, yes, that was probably... not what most people tune into this podcast to listen to, about 19th century British politics, but I just wanted to say a bit more about that book. Anyway, it's I'm still reading it slowly. I've got another book on the go. I decided to go. I haven't read Terry Pratchett in years, but I fancied a nice, good, slightly surreal read, and I went back to Pratchett, and I'm reading Going Postal at the moment as well. And when I'm not reading now, I'll just pick up The Forgotten Prime Minister and keep badgering on through that as well. But yeah, Going Postal, good fun read as well. I'm enjoying that.
Yeah, I've been super, super busy recently, so I've only been working on one book, Hyperspace by Michio Kaku, and it's all about a scientific odyssey through the 10th dimension. And it started out a bit slow, and I'd started it ages ago and kind of put it down to move on to other books, but I've kind of run through my pile, so I picked it back up again, and it's been really, really good. It's got my head spinning about some brilliant ideas, trying to visualize fourth dimensional tesseracts and how to move around. But toward the end of the book, it starts moving a bit more sci-fi as well, talking about what's going to happen. Is there going to be the big crunch? Is the big bang? But it goes into a couple of things that I've read before, but he kind of pulls them all together. He's talking about the Drake equation, which is all about what are the if there's a 100 billions and billions of stars out there, and we'll say 10% of them have life, and or 10% of them have a decent sun, 10% of those have planets in the right place, 10% of those, 10%, all these wildly small probabilities, still there should be 200,000 planets just like our Earth with intelligent life on it, just by the percentages. And he goes into something I'd never heard of, astro chickens, and that's a brilliant idea. The X Prize and NASA and all these companies are, getting big ships with people out into outer space, and the astro chicken is just an idea to build 1 kilogram, half kind of organic, half machine that just goes autonomously and eats the ice of lunar rings and tries to do its own thing, and then when it can, beams information back to Earth. And the idea is that you build loads of these and just throw them out there. So instead of one big shuttle mission, you have lots. But yeah, then he goes on to talk about Kardashev scales. I don't know if I said that right, but yeah, how the Earth is, you know, right now our civilization is type zero, then you can move into a type one civilization, then type two, and then type three, and how all this affects the amount of energy we can harness from the universe and the galaxy. And it's not until we get to type two or type threes that we can start understanding 10th dimensions. And it's really good toward the end, so I highly recommend it.
So yeah, there we go. If you fancy reading any of those books we just mentioned, you'll find the links in the show notes for this episode, to links to Amazon, so you can buy them from there if you want. Or you can just do what I do and go down to the local public library, take the book out on loan, and then forget that you've got to take it back and pay a small fee.
That has been episode number 10 of North Atlantic Radio. As always, you can send us your feedback at hello@northatlanticradio.com. And we hope everyone has a lovely holidays this, you know, Christmas and New Year's. And you'll be listening to us on all your travels. So a little longer than normal, but hope you enjoy.
Yep. And I don't think we've mentioned yet, but that was episode 10. Next one, episode 11, will be the last of this series, and we're going to take a break. You can look forward to that, and then you can look forward to a holiday free of Brian and I. But before that, we hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.